Chapter 84. At myself when the boy glared on me so. But he turned and followed, when I beckoned to him, and finding that he acknowledged that influence in me, I led the way straight home. It was not far, only at the summit of the hill. We passed but one man. I doubted if we should have got home without assistance, the boy's steps were so uncertain and tremulous. He made no complaint, however, and was strangely unconcerned about himself, if I may say so strange a thing. Leaving him in the hall for a moment, shrunk into the corner of the window seat and staring with an indifference that scarcely could be called wonder at the comfort and brightness about him, I went into the drawing room to speak to my guardian. There I found Mr. Skimpole, who had come down by the coach, as he frequently did without notice, and never bringing any clothes with him, but always borrowing everything he wanted. They came out with me directly, to look at the boy. The servants had gathered in the hall too, and he shivered in the window seat with Charlie standing by him, like some wounded animal that had been found in a ditch. "This is a sorrowful case," said my guardian, after asking him a question or two and touching him, and examining his eyes. "What do you say, Harold?" "You had better turn him out," said Mr. Skimpole. "What do you mean?" inquired my guardian, almost sternly. "My dear Jarndyce," said Mr. Skimpole, "you know what I am. I am a child. Be cross to me, if I deserve it. But I have a constitutional objection to this sort of thing. I always had, when I was a medical man. He's not safe, you know. There's a very bad sort of fever about him." Mr. Skimpole had retreated from the hall to the drawing room again, and said this in his airy way, seated on the music stool as we stood by. "You'll say it's childish," observed Mr. Skimpole, looking gaily at us. "Well, I dare say it may be, but I am a child, and I never pretend to be anything else. If you put him out in the road, you only put him where he was before. He will be no worse off than he was, you know. Even make him better off, if you like. Give him 6 pence, or 5 shillings, or £5.10, you are arithmeticians, and I am not, and get rid of him." "And what is he to do then?" asked my guardian. "Upon my life," said Mr. Skimpole, shrugging his shoulders with his engaging smile, "I have not the least idea what he is to do then. But I have no doubt he'll do it." "Now, is it not a horrible reflection," said my guardian, to whom I had hastily explained the unavailing efforts of the two women, "is it not a horrible reflection, walking up and down and rumpling his hair, that if this wretched creature were a convicted prisoner, his hospital would be wide open to him, and he would be as well taken care of as any sick boy in the kingdom?" "My dear Jarndyce," returned Mr. Skimpole, "you'll pardon the simplicity of the question, coming as it does from a creature who is perfectly simple in worldly matters, but why isn't he a prisoner then?" My guardian stopped and looked at him with a whimsical mixture of amusement and indignation in his face. "Our young friend is not to be suspected of any delicacy, I should imagine," said Mr. Skimpole, unabashed and candid. "It seems to me that it would be wiser, as well as in a certain kind of way more respectable, if he showed some misdirected energy that got him into prison. There would be more of an adventurous spirit in it, and consequently more of a certain sort of poetry." "I believe," returned my guardian, resuming his uneasy walk, "that there is not such another child on earth as yourself." "Do you really?" said Mr. Skimpole. "I dare say. But I confess I don't see why our young friend, in his degree, should not seek to invest himself with such poetry as is open to him. He is no doubt born with an appetite. Probably, when he is in a safer state of health, he has an excellent appetite." "Very well. At our young friend's natural dinner hour, most likely about noon, our young friend says in effect to society, 'I am hungry, will you have the goodness to produce your spoon and feed me?'" Society, which has taken upon itself the general arrangement of the whole system of spoons, and professes to have a spoon for our young friend, does not produce that spoon, And our young friend, therefore, says you really must excuse me if I seize it. Apostrophe now, this appears to me a case of misdirected energy, which has a certain amount of reason in it, and a certain amount of romance, and I don't know, but what I should be more interested in our young friend, as an illustration of such a case, than merely as a poor vagabond which anyone can be. In the meantime, I ventured to observe, he is getting worse. In the meantime, said Mr. Skimpole cheerfully, as Miss Summerson, with her practical good sense, observes, he is getting worse. Therefore I recommend your turning him out before he gets still worse. The amiable face with which he said it, I think I shall never forget. Of course, little woman, observed my guardian, tuming to me, I can ensure his admission into the proper place by merely going there to enforce it, though it's a bad state of things when, in his condition, that is necessary. But it's growing late, and is a very bad night, and the boy is worn out already. There is a bed in the wholesome loft room by the stable. We had better keep him there till morning, when he can be wrapped up and removed. We'll do that. Oh, said Mr. Skimpole, with his hands upon the keys of the piano as we moved away. Are you going back to our young friend? Yes, said my guardian. How I envy you your constitution, Jarndyce, returned Mr. Skimpole with playful admiration. You don't mind these things, neither does Miss Summerson. You are ready at all times to go anywhere, and do anything. Such as will. I have no will at all, and no one simply can't. You can't recommend anything for the boy, I suppose? Said my guardian, looking back over his shoulder half-angrily, only half-angrily, for he never seemed to consider Mr. Skimpole an accountable being. My dear Jarndyce, I observed a bottle of cooling medicine in his pocket, and it's impossible for him to do better than take it. You can tell him to sprinkle a little vinegar about the place where he sleeps, and to keep it moderately cool and immoderately warm. But it is mere impertinence in me to offer any recommendation. Miss Summerson has such a knowledge of detail, and such a capacity for the administration of detail, that she knows all about it. We went back into the hall and explained to Joe what we proposed to do, which Charlie explained to him again, and which he received with the languid unconcern I had already noticed, wearily looking on at what was done, as if it were for somebody else. The servants compassionating his miserable state, and being very anxious to help, we soon got the loft room ready, and some of the men about the house carried him across the wet yard, well wrapped up. It was pleasant to observe how kind they were to him, and how there appeared to be a general impression among them that frequently calling him old chap was likely to revive his spirits. Charlie directed the operations, and went to and fro between the loft room and the house with such little stimulants and comforts as we thought it safe to give him. My guardian himself saw him before he was left for the night and reported to me, when he returned to the growlery, to write a letter on the boy's behalf, which a messenger was charged to deliver at daylight in the morning, that he seemed easier and inclined to sleep. They had fastened his door on the outside, he said, in case of his being delirious, but had so arranged that he could not make any noise without being heard. Ada being in our room with a cold, Mr. Skimpole was left alone all this time, and entertained himself by playing snatches of pathetic airs, and sometimes singing to them as we heard at a distance, with great expression and feeling. When we rejoined him in the drawing room, he said he would give us a little ballad which had come into his head apropos of our young friend, and he sang one about a peasant boy, thrown on the wide world, doomed to wander and roam, bereft of his parents, bereft of a home. Quite exquisitely. It was a song that always made him cry, he told us. He was extremely gay all the rest of the evening, for he absolutely chirped those were his delighted words, when he thought by what a happy talent for business he was surrounded. He gave us, in his glass of negus, better health to our young friend, and supposed and gaily pursued the case of his being reserved like Whittington, to become Lord Mayor of London. In that event, no doubt, he would establish the Jarndyce Institution and the Summerson Almshouses, and a little annual corporation pilgrimage to St. Albans. He had no doubt, he said, that our young friend was an excellent boy in his way, but his way was not the Harold Skimpole way. What Harold Skimpole was, Harold Skimpole had found himself, to his considerable surprise, when he first made his own acquaintance. He had accepted himself with all his failings, and had thought it sound philosophy, to make the best of the bargain, and he hoped we would do the same. Charlie's last report was that the boy was quiet. I could see, from my window, the lantern they had left him burning quietly, and I went to bed very happy to think that he was sheltered. There was more movement and more talking than usual a little before daybreak, and it awoke me. As I was dressing, I looked out of my window, and asked one of our men who had been among the active sympathizers last night, whether there was anything wrong about the house. The lantern was still burning in the loft window. "It's the boy, miss," said he. "Is he worse?" I inquired. "Gone, miss."
"Dead."
"Dead, miss?"
"No.
Gone clean off." At what time of the night he had gone, or how, or why, it seemed hopeless ever to divine. The door remaining as it had been left, and the lantern standing in the window, it could only be supposed that he had got out by a trap in the floor which communicated with an empty cart house below. But he had shut it down again, if that were so, and it looked as if it had not been raised. Nothing of any kind was missing. On this fact being clearly ascertained, we all yielded to the painful belief that delirium had come upon him in the night and that, allured by some imaginary object or pursued by some imaginary horror, he had strayed away in that worse than helpless state. All of us, that is to say, but Mr. Skimpole, who repeatedly suggested, in his usual easy light style, that it had occurred to our young friend that he was not a safe inmate, having a bad kind of fever upon him, and that he had with great natural politeness taken himself off. Every possible inquiry was made, and every place was searched. The brick kilns were examined, the cottages were visited, the two women were particularly questioned. But they knew nothing of him, and nobody could doubt that their wonder was genuine. The weather had for some time been too wet, and the night itself had been too wet to admit of any tracing by footsteps. Hedge and ditch, and wall, and rick and stack, were examined by our men for a long distance round, lest the boy should be lying in such a place insensible or dead. But nothing was seen to indicate that he had ever been near. From the time when he was left in the loft room, he vanished. The search continued for 5 days. I do not mean that it ceased even then, but that my attention was then diverted into a current very memorable to me. As Charlie was at her writing again in my room in the evening, and as I sat opposite to her at work, I felt the table tremble. Looking up, I saw my little maid shivering from head to foot. "Charlie," said I, "are you so cold?" "I think I am, miss," she replied. "I don't know what it is. I can't hold myself still. I felt so yesterday at about this same time, miss. Don't be uneasy, I think I'm ill." I heard Ada's voice outside, and I hurried to the door of communication between my room and our pretty sitting room, and locked it. Just in time, for she tapped at it, while my hand was yet upon the key. Ada called to me to let her in, but I said, "Not now, my dearest. Go away. There's nothing the matter. I will come to you presently." Ah! It was a long, long time before my darling girl and I were companions again. Charlie fell ill. In 12 hours she was very ill. I moved her to my room, and laid her in my bed, and sat down quietly to nurse her. I told my guardian all about it, and why I felt it was necessary that I should seclude myself, and my reason for not seeing my darling above all. At first she came very often to the door, and called to me, and even reproached me with sobs and tears. But I wrote her a long letter saying that she made me anxious and unhappy and imploring her, as she loved me, and wished my mind to be at peace, to come no nearer than the garden. After that she came beneath the window even oftener than she had come to the door, and if I had learned to love her dear sweet voice before when we were hardly ever apart, how did I learn to love it then, when I stood behind the window curtain listening and replying, but not so much as looking out? How did I learn to love it afterwards, when the harder time came? They put a bed for me in our sitting room, and by keeping the door wide open, I turned the two rooms into one, now that Ada had vacated that part of the house, and kept them always fresh and airy. There was not a servant in, or about the house, but was so good, that they would almost gladly have come to me at any hour of the day or night without the least fear or unwillingness. But I thought it best to choose one worthy woman who was never to see Ada, and whom I could trust to come and go with all precaution. Through her means I got out to take the air with my guardian, when there was no fear of meeting Ada, and wanted for nothing in the way of attendance, any more than in any other respect. And thus poor Charlie sickened and grew worse, and fell into heavy danger of death, and lay severely ill for many a long round of day and night. So patient she was, so uncomplaining, and inspired by such a gentle fortitude, that very often as I sat by Charlie holding her head in my arms repose would come to her. So, when it would come to her in no other attitude I silently prayed to our Father in heaven, that I might not forget the lesson which this little sister taught me. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.